It's time now for America in the Balance. Brought to you by Oklahomans for Sovereignty and Free Enterprise. And now your co-hosts, Amanda Teagarden and Don Wyatt.
And welcome, freedom-loving Oklahomans, to another hour of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Amanda Teagarden, in studio with Don Wyatt.
Delighted to be here. It's kind of a special, almost somber day since, as we record this, we're commemorating and celebrating the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on America. And for the last week and all morning, I guess, most of us have been looking and reflecting, looking at history, video, listening to audio, looking at the recordings and words and documents and pictures, and bringing back to mind all of those events from 10 years back.
And I would agree that probably most people looking back will remember exactly what they were doing when they got the news and heard what was happening in New York City and in Pennsylvania and at the Pentagon. Yeah. And things have changed quite a bit, and not all for the good since then.
It certainly has changed our society and culture in a number of rather unpleasant ways.
Try going to the airport.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we are broadcasting from Oklahoma. We're from OK Safe. That's OK-Safe.com. That's OK-SAFE.com. Lots of good information there. The website is going through a transition phase, so you might want to check back and see if you find some of the pages a little easier to manipulate and maneuver. We've got information there that has to do with the Oklahoma's implementation of Obamacare,
right.
The China connection, that's a new link that's there,
that's right.
That has the information that has to do with the recent Governor's Forum, the National Governor's Forum in Salt Lake City, Utah, where four provincial leaders from China, different provinces in China, and party representatives of, that would be the Communist Party.
Yeah, we used to call it Red China, didn't we?
We did. And, well, they were welcomed with open arms and honored, and yours truly was able to attend one half of those simultaneous conferences that got to hear those same legislators.
Thank you for being there and representing our interest and being eyes for us there, and allowing us to capture in posterity on the cyberspace some information about that.
There are some good photos. I was able to capture some good photographic evidence of what was happening there. Plus, I have two of the three transcripts done on different speeches that were presented there, and both of those transcripts are on the website. Our blog site is a link just a click away, and that's oksafe.wordpress.com if you want to go there directly. We are privileged today to have as our guest, as Don intimated earlier, we have a good guest today that we're fortunate took time out of his busy schedule to be with us to discuss that issue of Obamacare.
Yes.
And he's written an article called Obamacare Constitutionally Infirm. Our guest is Dr. John A. Sparks, and he is a working group coordinator and educational policy fellow, and he writes on a blog site called visionandvalues.org, and he's a contributor to that. And I'll read his bio, which is pretty extensive. John A. Sparks is dean of the Alva J. Calderwood School of Arts and Letters at Grove City College, where he teaches U.S. constitutional history and business law, and was the former chairman of the business department. A fellow for educational policy with the Center for Vision and Values, he has been named as H.B. Earhart Foundation Fellow, an R.C. Hoyles Fellow, a Chavon Fellow at Baylor University, Hank Amers School of Business, and has received the prestigious George Washington Honor Medal from the Freedoms Foundation in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. He was named Professor of the Year at both Hillsdale College, where he previously taught for 7 years, and Grove City College, where he began teaching in 1976, and received the highest alumni award from his alma mater, the Jack Kennedy Memorial Achievement Award. Sparks is a graduate of Grove City College with a BA in economics and received his Juris Doctor degree from the University of Michigan Law School. That's an impressive resume, and we're very fortunate to have him on, and we're going to talk about Obamacare. So we're going to welcome Dr. Sparks.
Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Don. Glad to be on.
It's our pleasure.
It is our pleasure, and I'm going to tell you right off the bat, Don's going to be asking the harder questions than I am. And what I would like to start out with is please give us a little bit of background on your constitutional law teachings and why you wrote the article called Obamacare Constitutionally Infirm.
Well, we watch closely. I have a constitutional history class, two-semester class. I teach at Grove City College, and we have a lot of pre-law students in there. That is, they're going to go on to law school. At Grove City, we take the Constitution seriously, and we think that we should look at the intent of provisions and the original intent of the drafters. Pay attention to that, that the court's job is to look at that intention when they're interpreting and not to institute sort of their own agendas by broad interpretation. So we're pretty narrow and strict constructionists when it comes to the Constitution. Otherwise, we think, why should you have a Constitution if you simply ignore it?
Absolutely.
That means that whenever there are decisions about constitutional provisions, we often will have something to say about that, and Obamacare presents various constitutional questions, one particularly that has been the subject of a lot of attention, the individual mandate in that legislation.
Right. I would guess that when we hear politicians and talking heads say that all constitutional experts agree that the Obamacare is constitutional, they're not including your opinion in that group, are they?
No, and they're not including, in many cases, a majority of the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well said.
So we now have cases challenging various parts of Obamacare going through the court system, and one of them I was writing about in this piece that you referred to about Obamacare constitutionally infirm.
Define infirm.
Well, the Constitution provides powers for the Congress, and those are found in a certain article. Article 1 of the Constitution sets out powers, and for the bulk of our constitutional life in this country, we've paid attention to that Congress cannot just enact legislation as it wishes, even though it might see a problem it thinks that it needs addressing. It has to stay within, conform to those powers that are given to it. It's not an unlimited government, it's a limited government, and they have to show that when they enact a piece of legislation like Obamacare, which is really called the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, that they have actual authority in the Constitution to do that.
As a history professor, I have heard on several occasions, and I'd like to get your read on this. I've heard that Madison opposed the Bill of Rights, for example, because his argument was that we've outlined in the Constitution in an affirmative way the specific things that we will permit the federal government to do, and he was opposed to starting to itemize things that they could not do for fear that list would be way too long to ever be reasonable. And I think his argument was, if we start outlining things that they can't do and we don't include everything, then there might be an argument that they were permitted to do it. Is that history legend that I've heard true?
No, that's true. Madison was an opponent of the Bill of Rights, even though eventually, because in some of the state ratifying conventions, the Constitution was drawn up in 1787 in Philadelphia in that 3-month period that summer, and then the states all had to ratify it because remember they were operating under a separate Constitution, the Articles of Confederation,
right.
And so they had to give their approval to this new constitution, and a number of states, Massachusetts, even Virginia itself, thought that there ought to be a separate Bill of Rights. After all, in English history, they'd had a Bill of Rights and various charters, and they thought that they ought to have that. Madison's argument, I think, he essentially stated correctly, and that is that he said, we've given only certain powers to this new federal government and no more.
Exactly.
And therefore, there's no reason for us to go about stating that we're limiting them, because we've only granted them certain powers, and that's it.
All right. And it's ironic over time, particularly since the 1920s, how much the preamble, clauses in the preamble about general welfare and regulating commerce have come to take precedence over so much of the delineated language in the Constitution, isn't it?
That's right. The especially the so-called Interstate Commerce Clause, which is, you know, sort of brings us to one of the essential arguments in this case that various states have brought against the federal government on the required or individual mandate.
Right.
The individual mandate, in case listeners, you know, the language is a little obscure, but the individual mandate means essentially that by 2014, all Americans have to purchase health insurance. They're required to do it by this provision. That's what a mandate means. You must do it.
And there are penalties if you don't.
And if they don't, they suffer a monetary penalty. And so therefore, the requirement is there that you must purchase this particular kind of good or service, and if you don't, you'll be penalized by the government, and the IRS would do the enforcing there, which of course doesn't make us feel any better. And the result is that provision, along with some others, have been challenged by the states as unconstitutional.
Right.
And the Obama administration has argued, when it gets into these disputes, has argued that this is regulating interstate commerce, and we have broad powers to regulate interstate commerce under the Commerce Clause, which certainly is there. I mean, there is a Commerce Clause. It says that Congress can regulate commerce between the states, and that's sometimes called the Interstate Commerce Clause, and that Commerce Clause has been, as you pointed out, broadly interpreted, especially in the New Deal era and on to the present day, as allowing the federal government to enact much of the regulatory legislation that it has passed. So if we have a regulatory state with lots of federal regulations and agencies, it's because of a very broad interpretation of the powers to regulate interstate commerce.
I was just going to say, when the founders used those specific words to regulate commerce, were they talking about limiting or bounding or controlling, or were they more correctly talking about to make consistent or to establish regularity?
That's right. It's the latter. In fact, in the first case that lots of students read, Gibbons versus Ogden, an old case, the Supreme Court found that New York State could not prevent people from engaging in interstate commerce. In other words, it tried to make regular or freer the paths of interstate commerce.
Right.
A fostering of commercial activity,
as opposed
so that
to,
states didn't interfere with it.
Right, exactly. They didn't want to create border wars between the states or the colonies, as they had previously been known. Yeah,
and really been pretty successful there. We have a huge free market, and even in Europe today, they're still trying to do that.
Well said.
What we have are two different court decisions, or pretty well-known court decisions. One from the Florida court, which that judge found that the individual mandate was not severable, and that the whole bill or that it was severable and that the whole bill is unconstitutional, by the way, and should be thrown out. Then the 11th Circuit of Court of Appeals issued an opinion, I think it was about a month or so ago, saying that it was severable, and that what they found was that the individual mandate was unconstitutional but didn't have a problem with the rest of it. So you have two different opinions causing it to go to the...
Well, there's actually more. I think we've had...
there's a Sixth Circuit.
Exactly.
And that's the new one.
Is it correct? Help us with the scorekeeping here, Dr. Sparks. Is it correct that as of right now at the appellate level, there are two circuit courts that have ruled in favor of the government's position and one that's ruled opposing it? Is that where we stand?
Well, it's a little more complicated. The 11th Circuit, well, you know how these cases start. They start in the lowest federal court, in a district court. That's
right.
Where the case is first filed.
Right.
And that Florida decision was filed there by the Florida Attorney General. And then there was an appeal to the 11th Circuit, which is the second federal level, just one level short of the U.S. Supreme Court. And
that's in Atlanta.
That's in Atlanta, right. Yeah. And that... generally, when they hear a case for the first time, all of the judges in the circuit don't hear it. Just three hear
right.
it.
A panel,
and
right.
so they have a panel, and so there were three judges that heard this. Interestingly, one was a George H.W. Bush appointee, another was a Clinton appointee, and they agreed that the individual mandate was unconstitutional, and so. That's the decision that I was writing about in this piece, and I think they're right. I think that the question that they're trying to answer, which is what courts try to do, they're brought a really an issue or a question that they have to address, and among the ones they addressed was whether the federal government can make Americans purchase and maintain health insurance from a private company for the entirety of their lives.
Exactly.
And the two out of the three answered, no, that cannot be done. That's in fact, it's shocking and unprecedented and breathtaking. I'm quoting.
That's right.
Breathtaking
exactly.
In its expansive scope.
Right.
So that's the 11th Circuit. It's true that you have this severability question, but let's leave that aside for a minute.
Good.
Then when we come to the Sixth Circuit, they find that the individual mandate, which is Michigan, Ohio, that area, that the individual mandate is constitutional. So they interpret commerce more broadly. The 11th Circuit says, no, it can't go that far.
Right.
So on the individual mandate, you have those two circuits disagreeing.
And the Fourth
and
Circuit...
We've had this... The Fourth Circuit is confusing because they don't really... This was just issued a day or so ago.
Correct.
The Fourth Circuit throws out the case and says that the litigants, and this was Virginia, Virginia does not have standing.
Right.
And that means that you as a party, the party which was the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, doesn't really have standing to bring this case. And that's a sort of a technical question, but it's a very important one. That is, is Virginia really harmed by this? And Virginia argued that it was, but they thought that the individual mandate was mostly a burden on citizens, and Virginia had not included any actual citizens in the case.
Right.
So they never get to the actual, what we would call the merits of the case.
Right. There's no real judgment on the content or substance.
Yeah, there's no judgment about whether the required mandate, the required individual insurance mandate is constitutional or not. They never get to that issue because they say you as a party have no real right to be here arguing this.
And the position that Virginia had taken is that immediately after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, Virginia had passed legislation asserting that it was not required in the state, and they said that the conflict between their legislation and the federal legislation was ipso facto evidence of harm or damage, and that was what the Fourth Circuit ruled on. Is that right?
That's correct. They had passed state legislation, and which said citizens, Virginia citizens, don't have to purchase, you know, health insurance here. It's not required of them, and anybody that tries to tell them otherwise, I'm paraphrasing, of course, is not complying with Virginia law. So they said that there was this conflict between the Virginia legislation and the federal law, and that they therefore, as sort of representing Virginia citizens, could raise that issue. And the Fourth Circuit, a panel in the Fourth Circuit rejected that. What will happen? Now, I'm not sure whether they might appeal to the whole court, all the judges in the Fourth Circuit. That might be the next step. I don't know.
Now Oklahoma is a little different than the other states who have filed, because we filed a case on our own, and we filed an individual.
So did Virginia, actually.
But they did not precede it by changing their constitution. Actually passed a state question that amended our state constitution. And then the Attorney General filed the lawsuit in the Eastern District Court of Oklahoma, which will go to the Tenth Circuit Court.
Right.
And I'll read to you that what our Constitution was amended to read is that this is Section 37 of Article 2, and Article 2 is the Bill of Rights in the Oklahoma Constitution. And it says, provides in relevant part the to preserve the freedom of Oklahomans to provide for their health care. A law or rule shall not compel directly or indirectly any person, employer, or health care provider to participate in any health care system. Now, a little background on this, Dr. Sparks, is that there were two pieces of legislation introducing this ballot initiative. The wording was different. The stronger one, which is the one that we supported, did not make it to the ballot. This is what I would call the weaker version,
right,
because it says you don't participate. The other language actually said forced to buy,
right,
to purchase.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so now this lawsuit, our lawsuit in Oklahoma, goes on to say in Section 3, Section 1501 of the Act and Section 37 of Article 2 of the Oklahoma Constitution are conflicting provisions that cannot coexist. So the basis of ours is that you cannot compel people to purchase or participate in a healthcare system, and that's an important word to recognize, because it'll be a conflict of our own Constitution, not just a state law. And we're still waiting for Judge White,
right,
in the Eastern District Court to issue an opinion.
Yeah,
on
we
this.
Haven't had a ruling on that yet, and of course I would presume
that would be at the district court level. Yeah.
Yes, and I would presume that there's still appellate processes after that that we can anticipate as well.
Right, you'd go to your circuit, which
right,
would be
Tenth Circuit.
I think you're right; that's Tenth there, yeah. And. So you go to your circuit, that would be the second level in the federal court system,
right,
one just before the Supreme Court.
Right.
And I think that a constitutional provision is even stronger, you know, stronger than a statute like that which Virginia passed.
Right, but there still might be the question, as Virginia faced, as to whether or not we have standing, because have we in fact been harmed just because there's a conflict between the Constitution and the federal legislation? Maybe that doesn't yet constitute harm.
Well, that's what the government would be arguing.
Right.
They would be arguing that the individual mandate part of this has really only an impact upon individuals who have to buy this insurance.
Right.
Now, I think there's a pretty easy way to remedy that. You just include individuals as Florida did in the suit.
Right.
And you know, Florida citizens. But I also think that the individual mandate does, it's part of this total law, and the individual mandate does have an effect on increasing Medicaid eligibility.
Exactly. And that does affect the states.
And so therefore, you know, the individual mandate puts, since Medicaid is partially a state burden and partially a federal burden,
right,
as far as the funding,
right,
then when you have an individual mandate and move more people into the eligibility category by that individual mandate, then you really are increasing a burden on the state,
right,
itself.
Quickly, the Fourth Circuit was made up, that panel was made up of three judges, all Democrats, two of whom appointed by Obama. Does that sound right?
That's correct.
Well, somebody had to appoint
them.
it doesn't
always mean they'll rule, in his favor. But
I know.
Surely we would expect some favor being shown there.
You bet.
All right, that's the music indicating the end of the first half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. Our special guest today is Dr. John A. Sparks from Grove City College in Pennsylvania, and we're talking about the constitutionality of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. We're going to ask you to stick around during the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back.
Do you need to promote your business on the internet? The Truth in Focus Radio Network reaches listeners locally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and all across the United States. The shift is on from traditional media to internet marketing. Stay on the cutting edge with your business. Advertise with us today. Email radio at truthinfocus.org. You heard the word, so will they. Email us at radio at truthinfocus.org.
Canyon State Wireless is your hands-on source for design, sales, service, and installation of the best land mobile two-way radio systems. Check us out on the web at canyonstatewireless.com or call us for specific information at 866-458-4772, 866-458-4772. Canyon State Wireless. When you're serious about communication.
Hold on a little while longer. Hold on. If you feel today take it, if you hold on a little while longer, hold on a little while longer, hold on a little while longer, hold on.
Oh!
And welcome back to the second half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio, the only place you can go from gospel to rock.
I love that
during
song.
During the bottom of the hour. That's
I
a
love
great,
that song.
That's Hold On by Selah. Great group if you're interested. And our special guest today is Dr. John A. Sparks of Grove City College in Pennsylvania. And he's written an article on vision and values that appears on Vision and Values, and it's called Obamacare Constitutionally Infirm. And we've been discussing the various court decisions, one issued from the Florida court system, district court, and then the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals
in Atlanta,
a three-panel court. And then the more recent one, the
Fourth Circuit,
and there's a conflict between just about all of them,
right.
And that we're still waiting for Oklahoma's court, Eastern District Court, to make a decision on the lawsuit that we filed as an individual state. Okay. And Dr. Sparks, wanted to ask you a question, and this is just one as being a researcher for the last several years, is to find out exactly how much of our Constitution still exists. And my viewpoint is, or my realization that I've come to when I'm doing research and looking at it, is that this document kind of comes and goes into significance, or is referred to only in certain circumstances. But in general, I'm getting the impression we're operating more as a corporation with corporate interest rather than constitutional as a government, with a sovereign government. Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, the the Constitution surely has. We've had, you know, a number of amendments, but I think the actual problems that have been introduced as far as departing from the what the founders intended or the drafters of an amendment intended has been produced by court interpretation. So even though the words commerce among the states are still in the Constitution there, as literally as they were put in there originally, they haven't been changed by a constitutional amendment. Still, by very broad interpretation in this case, they have produced an effect very similar to increasing federal governmental power. And my students are always surprised, well, how did this happen? And it happened gradually by broader and broader interpretations of that clause, along with some others, but really the Interstate Commerce Clause is the clause that has served as a basis for most of the expansion of federal power. Back in 1995, however, for the first time for a long time, in a case involving a federal act, the Gun-Free Schools Act, which the federal government had passed, saying that you couldn't carry a gun to there's a zone around schools, and you couldn't carry a gun to school, and that was a violation of a federal law. The court finally, and that was during the Rehnquist era, finally balked and said, well, that's enough. You can't christen every piece of legislation saying that somehow it has an impact on interstate commerce and expect the federal government to be able to act on the basis of it. And they found that act unconstitutional. It wasn't that they were opposed to the idea of keeping guns out of school, but they said, is it the federal government's power, proper power and domain to be enacting a national law of that magnitude just based upon the fact that somehow, some way, interstate commerce might be affected by such an action? And the court threw it out, and a couple of other cases were decided around the same time, so that now there's certainly a possible majority in the Supreme Court that could say, even though interstate commerce has been very broadly interpreted, there is a limit. We can't go so far as to say that the failure to purchase something can be considered interstate commerce. Now, we're going to see what happens there. It's going to be a very close call, but I'm pretty sure that this case is going to go to the Supreme Court because we've got conflicts among the circuit. It's a central piece of legislation that affects the whole of the country. I think the court will take an appeal of one of the circuit decisions and then try to resolve the conflict that exists among the circuits. And it's going to be a very close call to see what happens, but I think it'll be one of the most significant decisions since World War II, certainly, as far right. as what we will be facing in loss of liberty if the government is allowed to mandate that we purchase certain goods and services, otherwise we're penalized.
Right.
On the subject of mandating a purchase, I can't remember where I read it, but one opinion was that without the individual mandate, the whole rest of the bill falls apart because there's no funding unless every American is forced to participate to create.
That was the government's argument in the Florida District Court case, wasn't it? I think so. They said
if the rest of it falls apart,
it will fall apart. Therefore, you can't separate it. You shouldn't rule that it's unconstitutional because the whole thing will fall apart.
Right.
That's
because
the
no
severability question, right. Which is a fancy word for can you take one of the cards out of the house of cards without the whole thing collapsing?
Great description.
And I think I happen to think that even though the 11th Circuit decided that the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals decided that the whole program could still stand without this piece in it, I think financially it would be badly hurt because, as you say, it does depend upon including a lot of people, especially younger people, my students,
exactly,
in this requirement to buy insurance when, in actuality, if they thought about it rationally, they might decide that at this point in time, given their age and likelihood of experiencing serious health problems, that they could decide to take a risk and not purchase.
Right.
And that would be their choice, just as they make other choices about the kinds of goods and services that they purchase.
Hey, Dr. Sparks, I don't want to interrupt this train of thought. In fact, I want to come back to it. But before we get time gets totally away from us, I know that you are at Hillsdale, and I would like to take advantage of the fact that we're talking to a professor from Hillsdale, from the faculty there. A lot of us out here in the internet world have heard of Hillsdale and maybe even subscribed to Imprimis or have some other association or connection with them. But I rarely, in fact, I've never had the opportunity to talk to a faculty representative from Hillsdale. Could you just share with our audience and with me a little bit more information about what Hillsdale really represents?
Well, Hillsdale and Grove City have both taken a similar position when it comes to the question of federal funding of higher education. In fact, when I was at Hillsdale for those 7 years, and I remember that was 30 years ago, so I can't speak for them very readily right now, but I know that these two schools, Grove City College, Hillsdale College, have both taken stances against federal funding of higher education, that we don't want all the baggage that comes with that,
right.
And so consequently, and in fact, Grove City brought a case that went to the Supreme Court, Grove City College case, in which it refused to be to sign a requirement that if its students got any kind of help, such as guaranteed student loans or Pell grants, that it did not regard that as federal financial assistance to college. The court ruled against us, and so consequently, we no longer accept Pell grants or guaranteed student loans. We provide all private monies for the education of Grove City College students.
Wow.
I think Hillsdale takes a similar stance. So these two schools have been, somewhat maverick schools when it comes to higher educational funding, and they put out Imprimis, we put out Vision and Values, and we do a lot of similar things. We're, I think, both dedicated to traditional constitutional government and limited government and free economic institutions and Christian values, and consequently, there's a lot of similarity. In fact, I think five of our students are going to Hillsdale this semester for a two-week or maybe it's a shorter, a few days session with students there, and then they're coming down here so that we have a exchange between the two schools that have similar, very similar stances. Super. We're a little bit bigger. We have 2,500 students. They have 1,100, 1,200. Their location is different, of course, but we have a lot of similarities of viewpoint.
What are the graduate programs available at the two schools? Do you know offhand?
Well, we're both of us are undergraduate schools, so we don't have graduate programs.
Okay. Very good. I apologize for the ignorance of the question. I was just
No, you
curious.
Can go on the websites of these schools, and you'll find plenty of information these days. You know, that's the way our students find out about us mostly these days. College bulletins and catalogs are sort of becoming a thing of the past.
Does Vision and Values have a monthly newsletter like Imprimis?
It doesn't have a hard copy. It sends out these op-eds, these opinion editorials, electronically. So if you want to get on that mailing list, they can. If they get on the Grove City College website and then go to Vision and Values, you can be added to that website.
Super.
And receive everything electronically.
Keeps your costs down on that, doesn't it?
It does. It does get very expensive to mail and tend to a list like that.
The Vision and Values web address is visionandvalues.org, and it's a great website, lots of good posts, good information, biographies of the professors and the contributors to the website, and an option to be notified of new posts there. All right, back on the, thank you for the background. You have another question?
Yeah, I had a
question.
Well,
we appreciate that.
Getting closer back to the subject matter that we're focusing on today. Can you, as a constitutional history expert and professor, can you think of any other instance in our past when there's been a federal law that 30 states all filed lawsuits against in an effort to get it overturned or repealed? And if you can think of such an instance, what was the subject matter and what was the result or outcome?
I can't think of anything, a federal law, that has produced so much really strongly worded responses as has the as this Obamacare. I suppose the prohibition period, probably there was strong feeling in states, but of course that was at least largely in favor of a prohibition law, and then that changed so that we got it repealed. But
right.
that's probably a case where there was a lot of interest in a federal law and its adoption. Nothing like this that I can remember has ever produced the kind of response that we have. And I think with the conflict in the circuits, this case is certainly going to the Supreme Court, and they're the ones who are going to have to settle it, and may not get settled before the 2012 election.
I will say that, though, there was pushback on another federal law, and that was the Real ID Act of 2005.
That's true, but it didn't take
it
the...
It did not go to the courts.
Yeah, it didn't
sure.
go through the courts. They just went through the
state's objective
nullification strategy and just, we won't
right.
do it.
We won't do it, and yet now they're still coming up with House Resolution 2124, or 64, is to try to come up with another national ID card of
right,
types
right.
with the biometrics in it. On the issue of zones, and I don't want to get too far off afield, but you mentioned it with the gun-free zones around schools, creating a zone where, let's say, for instance, your right to bear arms was infringed in the call, saying it was part of the Commerce Clause. There are other zones in the states that are developed that exist that have unique laws, and I don't know if you or your class you've made this an assignment or even looked into this, and that's the foreign trade zones. And it's looking like the foreign trade zones would be operating with a different set of laws. Have you had a chance to look into
yeah,
that?
And these zones, we also have We also had some experience with so-called enterprise zones.
That's right. Yes.
That create, you know, tax reductions in those zones.
Sometimes now, called hub, first, hub
I'm
zones.
I'm always glad for freer kinds of trade, and free economic activity and reductions in the amount of taxes.
And barriers.
However, on the other hand, if you're not in this zone, you don't get this treatment. And that means that people outside the zone are treated differently than the people that are in the zone. So I'm always reluctant to create specialized areas where there is different treatment for those people within those zones, because it seems to create a kind of inequitable result for those outside. I mean, here locally, for example, you have a lot of this, I'm sure, locally. You have school districts, a big company or concern or shopping center wants tax reductions if
exactly.
they'll locate there.
Exactly.
And the school district or whoever's doing the taxing, the county, says, okay, we'll give you this sweetheart deal if you'll come in. But on the other hand, the guy down the road, I happen to practice law, so I have some guys that live down the road, have gas stations or restaurants or something like that. They don't get this treatment.
That's right.
And it's only these special cases where the treatment is extended. So I basically think that if we're going to have legislation, it ought to be applicable to all the persons in that particular geographic area, not just to certain ones.
Would you be inclined to suggest maybe that the federal government has no right to create such zones with unfair treatment or unbalanced treatment between citizens, but the local governments may in fact have the authority to do so?
It's the local ones that
are
doing it.
I know.
Even the local ones, you know, are making giving specialized treatment. So in a particular
right.
county, if you're a new shopping center coming in, then you get this special treatment, but if you've been there for a long time with a gas station, you don't.
Right.
So I think even the local governments are departing from the idea of fair and even-handed treatment to all citizens.
Well, you're touching on things that it's been near and dear to us,
exactly.
and it has to do with the zones.
Right.
And it's you mentioned one, enterprise zones. The other name for them is commerce zones or hub zones. The hub zones are at the federal level. Economic development zones, economic development zones, and then the taxing issue is called a TIF district, tax increment
right.
financing district. We had an entire mall that was built in Tulsa that they defer their taxes and
right.
in anticipation of future sales. Well, of course, the economy beginning to tank.
Thanks.
Like, where? Yeah, so where yeah. are that? But they got in there with the big box stores,
right.
as they're referred
right.
to. And I'm not against that commerce, but it is not, as you say, it is not a level playing field. It is special treatment for certain industries. And certain states have been designated the builder of certain industries, and their schools are to produce certain workers for those industries. Oklahoma's been designated the aerospace and engineering. You'd think everybody was really intelligent, but it really, I shouldn't say that about the whole state. I'm sorry. What I'm trying to tell you is that the federal government, the Department of Labor, decided that that's the industry you're supposed to produce workers for.
That's right. Thank you very much, central planners.
Yes. And
yeah, that's right. I mean, this is central planning and the belief that this is the way to produce jobs and prosperity. And actually,
it's not working.
I think it's been said here recently over and over again in the national news, get the government out of these areas and let them protect us from external foes, and the state governments and local governments protect us from internal robbers and fraud
sure.
laden people, and let the people produce things and goods and services that they find willing buyers for,
right.
and then prosperity will return.
And benefit from the results of those efforts. Exactly.
Exactly.
Not have it taken away from them. I hate to put you in the crystal ball business, and if you're as bright as I know you to be, you'll probably just say, I have no idea what'll happen. But give us your best guess. It's certainly a more informed guess than we could make about the course of the legislation creeping up to the Supreme Court. A lot of the talking heads and media are expecting that it'll actually be heard by the Supreme Court in the next session and might actually be ruled on by spring or summer. Do you think that's realistic at all, or do you think it'll probably take a lot longer?
Well, I don't. That one we don't know, because Supreme Court has this sort of power to refuse an appeal. You know, it's not automatic.
Right.
However, and I think there was one effort to try to expedite the appeal, jump over the circuits, which
right.
wasn't received.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a possibility. I'd say it's fairly slim, but I certainly would be glad to see the court take it on, and then. I suppose your next question is, how do you think that will come out?
Right.
And that's going to be, I mean, we certainly know that, I think it's very likely that Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito, those four will find that this is going too far with the Interstate Commerce Clause, but as far right. as its individual mandate, Kennedy is going to be the one that we're not sure about.
Right.
I think he could swing over to that group, or he could join Ginsburg and Breyer and Sotomayor and Kagan
right.
and create 5-4 that way.
Right.
So that's I think that's going to be the
what's your best
I think his vote's going to be critical.
What's your best guess about the likelihood between now and the disposition of this case at the Supreme Court level that there is another change on the membership of the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, it sort of surprised me. I thought Ginsburg would, given her health, might be the one to resign, you know, before others that have here. But that's the way it goes. She's a very apparently very durable lady.
Right.
And
wouldn't she be?
You know, if any of those on the four more liberal side of the court resign, retire, then Obama will have another chance at appointment. However, there isn't a lot of time left here for that kind of thing, and
right.
I think the Republicans would probably do their best to try to slow that process down.
And the Senate's been weakened
if something were to happen.
The Senate's been weakened on the left after 2010
yeah.
as well, so. And
yeah.
after 2012, depending on what happens at the ballot box, it could be that a liberal replacement for Ginsburg would be unlikely to get through Congress at all.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. It's very hard to measure here now, but given public opinion about and dissatisfaction with Obama, we might have another 2010 election, and
right.
and things would change dramatically.
And for quite a long while, perhaps.
Yes.
I have no doubt whatsoever, though, that the interest groups, and I'm talking about the technology companies and the insurance industry, is going to do whatever they can to make sure people get enrolled in this system.
It sure sounds and looks like it.
Because there's a lot of money at stake. The state of Oklahoma just re-upped a contract with Hewlett-Packard Enterprise Systems for their Medicaid expansion, their
right.
anticipated expansion of Medicaid, to the tune of $281 million for
right.
that contract, in anticipation of increased enrollment in Medicaid.
Right.
Well, where are they coming from? Because the Obamacare. Definition yeah. of the federal poverty level
uh-huh.
was up to 400%. So
right.
as people's incomes decline, more people are going to be qualified for Medicare.
Right.
That'll be the insurance
right.
that they'll be offered, or health coverage that they'll be offered, and everybody will be enrolled into via the marketplace or the exchanges into a technology system that is going to divvy out care based on your worth as an individual.
That's right.
Because they'll have access to all of your medical history and see how productive you can be in the future. And so, okay, you get the bronze level health coverage, not the platinum.
Yeah. How long are you going to live and how much will you get back
for us? How much more work can we get out of you productively at the least amount of cost to the state?
Like trying to assess a mutual fund or something.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm uncertain that the... certainly you can't depend upon insurance companies that have been highly regulated industries and not used to competition because of state by state restrictions. Can't depend on them to be strongly in favor of a real competitive system or a change.
Yeah, they won't.
And that's too bad because it means that we find ourselves sometimes arrayed against. That's business people who we would
good
think
point.
Normally would want greater liberty.
Very good point. And we've seen that on a couple of surprising incidences down here in Oklahoma, too.
Legislators used to be insurance brokers.
Exactly.
Not quite understanding what he's getting into.
It's surprising.
But he wants to protect the insurance brokers as a business sector, white collar, who will not be needed because they'll be replaced with navigators, which is an electronic helper.
That's right.
To help you find your bronze, platinum, or silver or gold.
Hey, Dr. Sparks, before we run out of time, as a activist citizen down here in the American heartland of Oklahoma, what advice could you give me and others like me and other listeners as to what we can do to continue pushing the direction of the country more towards our constitutional founding as opposed to the direction that it's been generally trending in the last 80 years prior to the appointments of Alito and Roberts?
Well, I think that we have to do the kinds of things that you, the two of you, are doing here, and that is try to explain to people what the significance is of decisions, pieces of legislation, the tendency that will introduce into our economy and our social life, and speak out about it over and over again, even if. I mean, we really don't have a choice, do we? I mean, we could say we're tired of fighting this fight. We're weary of the sometimes a little progress we seem to be making, but the power of ideas is great indeed, and more mighty than the march of an army. And I think we can see that in the old Reagan Revolution. I think we can see it. Starting to resurface today in various movements and groups who are now convinced that unless something is done to move in another direction, we will be we'll be able to say at the end of another 20 or 25 years, we are now enslaved and we didn't really even realize the manacles that were being applied to us. So we have a real duty, I think, as citizens to oppose that kind of thing. And I know there are plenty who say, I don't care about this, I'm not concerned about it. But there are others, I think, who will move in that direction.
We have to do everything we can, those of us who are awake and aroused, to awaken and arouse our fellows, don't we?
I think that's right.
We do. We thank you, Dr. Sparks, for being our guest on America in the Balance. Our guest has been Dr. John A. Sparks from Grove City College in Pennsylvania. The website to see his post is visionandvalues.org, and we'll have to have him back again, and maybe there will be a decision at the Supreme Court on this very important issue that affects all of us.
I think as the news continues to develop here, it'd be great to have you back to assess it and analyze it for us if you're available.
I certainly will be glad to do that, Amanda and Don. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's the ending music. Thank you all for listening, and may God bless.